Critics said it was unfair to test students every year. I thought it was unfair not to. Measuring progress was the only way to find out which students needed help. Others complained about what they called teaching to the test. But if the test was well designed to measure knowledge of a subject, all the schools had to do was teach that subject. Another common claim was that No Child Left Behind was underfunded. That's hard to believe, given that we raised federal education spending by 39% over my 8 years in office, with much of the extra money going to the poorest students in schools. On a more fundamental level, the critics who complained about the money missed the point of No Child Left Behind. The premise of the law is that success cannot be measured by dollars spent. It has to be judged by results achieved. By the time I left office, 4th and 8th grade math scores had reached their highest levels in history. So had 4th grade reading scores. Hispanic and African American students set new records in multiple categories. The gap had narrowed in exactly the way we wanted. All students improved, but minority students improved the most. In January 2008, I visited Horace Greeley Elementary School in Chicago to mark the 6th anniversary of No Child Left Behind. The school, named for the 19th century abolitionist, was 70% Hispanic and 92% poor. It had outperformed most public schools in Chicago. Student proficiency in reading had risen from 51% in 2003 to 76% in 2007. Math proficiency had improved from 59% to 86%. It was uplifting to see a school full of low-income minority students thrive. A sixth grader, Yesenia Adam, said she enjoyed taking tests. "Then your teachers can know what you need help on," she explained. At the end of my visit, I told students, parents, and the press what I had long believed. No Child Left Behind is a piece of civil rights legislation. I used to quip that I was a product of a faith-based program. By 1986, faith had changed my heart, and I'd quit drinking. 10 years later, my eyes opened to the potential of faith-based programs to transform public policy. In June 1996, two African-American churches in the town of Greenville, Texas, were burned. Until 1965, a sign on the town's main street had advertised, "The blackest land, the whitest people." As governor, I feared we were witnessing a surge in old-time racism. I traveled to Greenville to condemn the burnings. A mixed-race crowd of about 4,000 people turned out in the football stadium. "From time to time, Texans boast that ours is a big state," I said. "But as big as this state is, it has no room for cowardice and hatred and bigotry." Then I gave the microphone to Tony Evans, a dynamic African-American pastor from Oak Cliff Bible Fellowship in Dallas. He told a story about a house with a crack in the wall. The owner hired a plasterer to cover the crack. A week later, the crack reappeared. So he hired another plasterer. A week later, the crack was back again. Finally, the homeowner called an old painter who took one look and said, "Son, first fix the foundation, then you can fix the crack in the wall." The crowd nodded and clapped. Then Tony turned to me. "Governor, I have something to say to you," he said. "Uh-oh," I thought. "Where is this headed?" "We need to fix the foundations," he said, "and your old government programs aren't doing the job." He said he had a better alternative. It was the most effective welfare system in the world. It had buildings on many street corners, a list of willing workers, and regular meetings to study the perfect manual for saving lives. He was talking about houses of worship, and he was right. Faith-based programs had the potential to change lives in ways secular ones never could. "Government can hand out money," I said, "but it cannot put hope in a person's heart or a sense of purpose in a person's life." I looked for ways for Texas to partner with faith-based organizations. I met with Chuck Colson, Richard Nixon's White House counsel, who had spent time in a federal penitentiary and found redemption. Chuck had founded an organization devoted to spreading the gospel behind bars. We agreed to start a faith-based program in one wing of a Texas prison. Chuck's program, the Inner Change Freedom Initiative, would provide instructors for Bible study and a life lessons course. The program would be optional and open to prisoners near the end of their sentences. Each inmate who participated would be connected with a mentor and welcomed into a church congregation upon release. In October 1997, I visited the Jester II prison near Sugar Land, Texas, where several dozen inmates had enrolled in Inner Change. At the end of the tour, a group of men in white jumpsuits filed into the courtyard. They formed a semicircle and struck up Amazing Grace. After a few stanzas, I joined the chorus. The next morning, Karen Hughes brought me the Houston Chronicle. There I was on the front page, shoulder to shoulder with the prison choir. The story noted that the man next to me, George Mason, had pled guilty to killing a woman 12 years earlier. That day in the prison yard, he did not seem like a murderer. He had a gentle manner and a kind smile. No question, he had become a spirit-filled man. When I ran for president, I decided to make a nationwide faith-based initiative a central part of my campaign. In my first major policy speech delivered in Indianapolis, I said, "In every instance where my administration sees a responsibility to help people, we will look first to faith-based organizations, to charities, and to community groups." 9 days after my inauguration, I issued executive orders creating an Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives in the White House and in 5 cabinet departments. The offices changed regulations and broke down barriers that had prevented faith-based charities from accessing the federal grant-making process. To emphasize the initiative's nonpartisan nature, I appointed Democrats to serve as the first 2 directors. One was John DeLulio, an innovative professor from the University of Pennsylvania. The other was Jim Toohey, a thoroughly decent man who had led Florida's Social Services Department and served as Mother Teresa's lawyer. I used to tell Toohey that we sure have a litigious society if Mother Teresa needed a lawyer. Some said the faith-based initiative blurred the line between church and state. I took that concern seriously. Government should never impose religion. Every citizen has the right to worship as he or she wishes, or not to worship at all. I was always wary of people who used faith as a political weapon, suggesting they were more righteous than their opponents. My favorite Bible verse for politicians is Matthew 7:3. "Why do you see the speck that is in your brother's eye, but do not notice the log that is in your own eye?" At the same time, government need not fear religion. If social service programs run by people of faith did not proselytize or discriminate against people receiving services, I thought they deserved a chance to compete for taxpayer dollars. The government should ask which organization would deliver the best results, not whether they had a cross, a crescent, or a Star of David on their wall. The initiative opened up roughly $20 billion a year in federal funding to competition from faith-based groups. Many of these organizations had no experience interfacing with government, so we held 40 conferences and more than 400 grant-writing seminars to help them apply for funding. Ultimately, more than 5,000 faith-based and community organizations, mostly small grassroots charities, received federal grants. In January 2008, I visited the Jericho Program of East Baltimore. Operated by Episcopal Community Services of Maryland and funded by a grant from the Department of Labor, the program provided mentoring, counseling, and job training services to recently released adult male convicts. The 9 men from Jericho were quiet when I walked into the room. I detected a fair amount of skepticism. "I drank too much at one point in my life," I said to break the ice, "and I understand how a changed heart can help you deal with addiction." The men opened up and told their stories. One had been convicted of selling drugs, another of cocaine possession, another of theft. Many had been in and out of prison several times and had abandoned their families. Thanks to the services they received at Jericho, they had begun to find purpose in their lives. One man emotionally explained how thrilled he was to have reunited with his three daughters. 6 months ago, I was broken down, he said. Now I am shaking hands with the president. Another told me proudly that he had received two job offers. Drugs have always been a problem in my life, up until now, he said. Thanks to Jericho, he said, I got my groove. The Jericho program's recidivism rate was 22%, less than half of Baltimore's overall rate. The men I met that day were among 15,000 who had benefited from the Prisoner Reentry Initiative we launched in 2004. Their recidivism rate was 15%, one-third of the national average. My most extraordinary meeting on faith-based initiatives took place right across the hall from the Oval Office. In June 2003, I had convened a roundtable discussion with faith-based leaders. Chuck Colson and several members of Inner Change attended. When I stepped into the Roosevelt Room, I spotted a familiar-looking African-American man. I walked over and gave him a big hug. I'm sure glad you're here, I said. It was George Mason, the man from the prison choir in Sugar Land. Upon release, he had earned a job as a janitor at his church. He also led a Bible study and served as a mentor for others leaving prison. What a testimony to the redemptive power of Christ. George Mason and George W. Bush, together in the West Wing. Created by President Johnson in 1965, Medicare had helped countless seniors enjoy healthier lives. But while medicine had advanced, Medicare had not. Benefits were determined by a government bureaucracy that was wasteful and very slow to change. When private insurers added mammogram coverage to protect against breast cancer, it took Medicare 10 years and an act of Congress to catch up. Medicare's most antiquated feature was that it did not cover prescription drugs. The program would pay $28,000 for ulcer surgery, but not $500 a year for pills that would prevent most ulcers. I was struck by the stories of older Americans who had to choose between buying groceries and medicine. One 69-year-old woman I met, Mary Jane Jones of Virginia, had to work 20 hours a week just to afford her nearly $500 a month bill for prescription drugs and insulin. She told me she sometimes used needles three or four times to save money. Medicare wasn't just outdated, it was going broke. The combination of rising health costs and the upcoming retirement of the baby boom generation had created a $13 trillion unfunded liability. The next generation would get stuck with the bill. The rising costs bankrupting Medicare affected the whole healthcare system. America's health spending had doubled from about 7.5% of GDP in 1972 to more than 15% in 2002. Part of the explanation was the cost of new medical technology. Junk lawsuits also played a role. But the primary cause was a fundamental flaw in the system. Most people had no idea what their health care cost. Seniors and the poor had their bills paid by the government through Medicare and Medicaid. Most working Americans received coverage through their employers and relied on a third party, an insurance company, to negotiate prices and determine payments. Many self-employed Americans couldn't afford health insurance because the tax code disadvantaged them, and regulations prohibited small business owners from pooling risk across jurisdictional boundaries. What the system lacked was market forces. There was no sense of consumerism or ability to shop around for the best deal, no competition for customers' business, and no transparency about quality and price. As a result, there was little incentive for doctors or patients to limit the resources they consumed, which was crucial to holding down costs. I saw reforming Medicare as a way to solve two problems. First, by adding a prescription drug benefit, we would modernize the program and provide seniors with the quality health care their government had promised. Second, by delivering the drug benefit through private insurance plans that compete for seniors' business, we could inject market forces into the health care system. Reforming the program would also create an opportunity to expand Medicare Plus Choice, later renamed Medicare Advantage, which allowed seniors to obtain all their health care through flexible, affordable, private insurance plans. I knew Medicare reform would be a tough political issue. Introducing market forces into a government health program would upset the left. Adding an expensive prescription drug benefit would be unpopular with the right. But I decided to take on the challenge. Under our plan, seniors who wanted the new prescription drug benefit would have to choose private plans instead of government-run Medicare. We would change Medicare's funding formula so that the government-run program had to compete with private plans on a level playing field. Both reforms would introduce more market forces and help address the rising costs of health care. Before announcing my plan publicly, I previewed it with Republican leaders in the House. They told me my proposal didn't stand a chance on Capitol Hill. Democrats would never support a bill that required seniors to give up their government-run Medicare coverage to receive a prescription drug benefit. Some Republicans wouldn't either. I faced a tough decision. I could fight for a lost cause or make a compromise. I decided to propose a prescription drug benefit that would be administered by private health plans but open to all seniors, including those who wanted to keep government-run Medicare coverage. My Medicare team worked closely with Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist and Finance Committee Chairman Chuck Grassley of Iowa. Chuck wisely brought two key Democratic counterparts, Senators Max Baucus of Montana and John Breaux of Louisiana, into the drafting process. They produced a solid bill that garnered support from 35 Democrats. The Senate passed the bill in June by a vote of 76 to 21. In the House, some conservatives balked at the cost of the drug benefit, which we eventually estimated at $634 billion over 10 years. But Speaker Denny Hastert, Majority Leader Tom DeLay, and Ways and Means Committee Chairman Bill Thomas built a fragile coalition to pass the bill 216 to 215. Just 9 House Democrats voted for a benefit they had demanded for years. The rest voted no. During the debate on the floor of Congress, not a single Democrat criticized the Medicare bill for costing too much. Most wanted to spend more money. The razor-thin House margin made it essential that the House and Senate bills be combined in a way that retained Republican support. To address cost concerns, we included a so-called trigger provision that would take effect if Medicare spending rose faster than expected. Congress would then be required to make reforms to address the problem. We also highlighted health savings accounts, an innovative new health insurance product created by the House bill. Designed to make coverage affordable for small businesses and individuals, HSAs coupled low-premium, high-deductible insurance against catastrophic illness with a tax-free savings account to pay routine medical expenses. Employers or individuals could contribute to the account, which belonged to the individual and could be taken from job to job. Because HSA owners paid their own health care expenses and kept any money left over, they had incentives to stay healthy, shop for good deals, and negotiate better prices. In mid-November, AARP, the influential seniors advocacy group, endorsed the compromise bill. This is not a perfect bill, but America cannot wait for the perfect, CEO Bill Novelli said. He was then excoriated by Democratic leaders, labor unions, and liberal editorial pages. But his stand went a long way with wavering members of Congress. The decisive vote came on November 21, 2003. Laura and I had long been scheduled to spend that day in Great Britain. As part of the first official state visit there by an American president since Woodrow Wilson, some suggested postponing the trip. I refused. They have phones in London, you know, I reminded the team. Laura and I enjoyed spending time with Queen Elizabeth II, a gracious, charming woman with a keen sense of humor. In 2007, Her Majesty and Prince Philip came to celebrate the 400th anniversary of the Jamestown settlement. In my welcoming remarks before 7,000 people on the South Lawn, I thanked the Queen for her long friendship with America. You helped our nation celebrate its bicentennial in 17... I caught myself before I could finish the date. 1776. A rough year in U.S.-British relations, and an unflattering commentary on the Queen's longevity. The 81-year-old monarch glanced at me with a wry smile. She gave me a look that only a mother could give a child, I said. At a dinner at the British Embassy the next night, Her Majesty said, I wondered whether I should start this toast by saying, when I was here, in 1776. Queen Elizabeth's hospitality at Buckingham Palace during our 2003 state visit was exquisite. We received a 41-gun salute, inspected the royal troops in the courtyard, and slept in the immaculately appointed Belgian suite. Our room had been occupied by Queen Elizabeth's uncle, King Edward VIII, before he abdicated the throne in 1936 to marry an American divorcee. It included a 300-year-old mirror, some 10 million British pounds, $15 million, worth of antiques, and a beautiful view of the palace gardens. At our afternoon tea with Her Majesty and Prince Philip, I asked the Queen about her dogs. A few minutes later, a royal footman appeared with her famous corgis. They were friendly and polite. My only hope was that if Barney ever met the Queen, he would behave as well as they did, and not bark for Scottish independence. That evening, Her Majesty and Prince Philip gave an elegant state banquet in our honor. Our places were set with 10 pieces of silverware and 7 crystal wine goblets. Evidently, word hadn't reached the royal pantry that I had quit drinking. Before I stood to make my toast and white tie and tails, I looked over at Laura in her beautiful burgundy gown. I wondered if she was thinking what I was. We've come a long way from that backyard barbecue in Midland. The stateliness of Buckingham Palace marked a stark contrast to what awaited on the flight home. As Air Force One took off, Legislative Director David Hobbs called me with a list of about a dozen wavering House members, mostly conservatives. I started dialing for votes over the Atlantic. Several congressmen were unavailable to take my call. One junior member did answer. I didn't come to Washington to increase the size of government, he told me. You know what? I didn't either, I answered. I came to make sure the government works. If we're going to have a Medicare program, it ought to be modern, not broken. This is just another entitlement that will keep growing forever, he said. So are you for abolishing Medicare? I responded. This is an opportunity to introduce competition into the system and hold down costs. Just so you know, this is a hell of a lot better deal than you're going to get from any other president. He wasn't persuaded. When I landed in Washington, I made another round of calls. We were making some headway, but it was going to be tight. When the House voted at 3 a.m., the initial count came up short. Speaker Denny Hastert took the rare step of holding the vote open in the hope he could persuade a few congressmen to change their votes. Just before 5 a.m., David Hobbs woke me up with a call from the Capitol. We need 2 more votes, he said. Can you talk to a few more members? He passed his cell phone around to several Republicans who might be persuaded to change their minds. I argued the case as best I could, given my jet lag. David called back a little while later. Miracle of miracles. The House had passed the bill 220 to 215. The Senate followed a few days later. I signed the Medicare Modernization Act of 2003 on December 8, 2003, at Constitution Hall. Behind me on the stage was a group of seniors who would benefit from the new law. One was Mary Jane Jones, the woman from Virginia who had to reuse her needles to afford insulin. The prescription drug benefit would save her an estimated $2,700 a year. The new law called for the prescription drug benefit to take effect on January 1, 2006. Skeptics said that seniors would have trouble picking from all the competing private options. I disagreed. I believed that seniors were plenty capable of making decisions about their lives, and that the government ought to trust them to do so. My effective Secretary of Health and Human Services, Mike Leavitt, worked with Medicare Administrator Mark McClellan and his team on a massive public outreach campaign. It paid off. More than 22 million seniors signed up for a prescription drug benefit during the initial 5-month enrollment period. In a 2008 survey, 90% of Medicare prescription drug recipients and 95% of low-income beneficiaries said they were satisfied with the program. Ultimately, Medicare modernization was a trade-off. We created a needed new benefit, but spent more money than I wanted. We introduced market-based competition among private drug plans, but we were unable to use the new benefit as leverage to move more seniors from government-run Medicare to private Medicare Advantage plans. We created health savings accounts, but we could not convince Congress to require government-run Medicare to compete on a level playing field with private plans. By the time I left office, more than 90% of Medicare beneficiaries had coverage for prescription drugs. 10 million were enrolled in private sector health care plans through Medicare Advantage. Almost 7 million Americans owned health savings accounts, more than a third of whom had not previously owned health insurance. Thanks to competition between private sector plans, the average monthly premium for prescription drug coverage dropped from an initial estimate of $35 to $23 the first year. By 2008, the initial estimate of $634 billion had dropped below $400 billion. The Medicare prescription drug benefit became one of the few government programs ever to come in well under budget. Market forces had worked, and we had moved America's healthcare system in the right direction, away from government control, and toward the choices and competition of a private market system, which is the best way to control costs in the long run. "I'm optimistic," I told Dad as we hunted quail in South Texas on New Year's Day 2004. "This election is going to come down to who knows how to lead, who will take on the big issues, and who can keep America safe." Dad was concerned. For months he had watched the Democratic presidential candidates take swings at me every day. The poundings were having an impact. My approval ratings had topped 90% after 9/11 and 75% after the liberation of Iraq. By the end of 2003, I had dropped to the 50s in some polls. Dad had seen the pattern before. His approval rating had skyrocketed in 1991, then crashed before the 1992 election. I assured him that our mutual friend, Karl Rove, had developed a solid campaign strategy. "If we do this right, it'll come out just fine," I said, "especially if they nominate Howard Dean." I knew the Democratic frontrunner, former governor of Vermont, from events we had attended in the 1990s. Dean was loud, shrill, and undisciplined. I was pulling hard for him to get the nomination. Unfortunately, Dean's lead evaporated before he won a single delegate. Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts claimed an upset victory in Iowa, won the New Hampshire primary, and cruised to the nomination. A Vietnam veteran and 4-term senator, Kerry was a hard worker, a polished debater, and a tough campaigner. I considered him a formidable opponent. Kerry also had weaknesses. He had the process-oriented mindset of a longtime legislator and a voting record that qualified as the most liberal in the Senate. In the fall of 2003, he had voted against an $87 billion bill to fund troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. Shortly after he clinched the nomination, my campaign ran an ad highlighting his position. Kerry responded, "I actually did vote for the $87 billion before I voted against it." I spoke to Carl the moment I heard the soundbite. "There's our opening," I said. "The American people expect their president to take a clear stand and defend it, especially when it comes to supporting troops in combat." We grabbed the flip-flop theme and ran with it for the rest of the campaign. On March 10, 2004, I received a letter from Jenna, who was in her senior year at the University of Texas. In 2000, neither Jenna nor Barbara had attended a single campaign event. They had made it clear they wanted nothing to do with politics, so it was quite a surprise to read Jenna's words. "Dear Dad, I had a vivid dream last night, a dream so vivid I woke in tears. Although I am not yet as spiritual as you, I have taken this dream as a sign. You have worked your entire life to give Barbara and me everything we have ever wanted or needed. You have given us love, support, and I know you have included us in every decision you have ever made. You and Mom have taught us the meaning of unconditional love. I watched as Mom selflessly, gently gave herself to Pa as he suffered. And I watched you give a year of your life to Gampy. I watched your shared pain on election night. At age 22, I finally have learned what that selfless pain must have felt like. I hate hearing lies about you. I hate when people criticize you. I hate that everybody can't see the person I love and respect, the person that I hope I someday will be like. It is because of all these reasons that I have decided that if you want me to, I would love to work full-time for you in the fall. Please think about it, talk to Mom about it, and get back to me. For now, I have stopped applying for jobs in New York. I know I may be a little rough around the edges, but with the proper training, I could get people to see the dad I love. This may seem like a rushed, impulsive decision, but I have been thinking about it constantly. I want to try to give you something for the 22 years you have given me. In my dream, I didn't help you, and I watched somebody win who isn't supposed to, and I cried. I cried for you, for our country, and for my guilt. I don't want my dream to become reality. So if I can help in any way, please let me. We can talk more about it during Easter. I love you, and I'm so proud of you. Love, Jenna." I still choke up when I read her sweet words, which also reflected Barbara's sentiments. I was thrilled they wanted to join the campaign. My last campaign would be their first. The first event Barbara and I attended together was a rally in front of 11,000 people in Marquette, Michigan, an Upper Peninsula town that hadn't seen a visit from a sitting president since William Howard Taft. Just before I gave my speech, Barbara took her seat in the front row behind the podium. The announcer introduced me and the audience roared. As I stepped up to the microphone, I turned to look at Barbara. She had tears streaming down her face. After 4 years on a college campus, she was surprised and touched to see such enthusiastic support for her dad. It reminded me of the feeling I had when I first heard a crowd cheer for my father. The circle was complete. In some ways, the 2004 campaign was easier than 2000. I benefited from the trappings of the presidency, especially Air Force One and Marine One. In another way, 2004 was tougher. I was both candidate and president. I had to strike a balance between the two. I drew energy from the people around me, especially Laura and the girls. I loved our bus tours through the Midwest, where thousands of citizens lined the main streets of small towns. One day in Wisconsin, we rolled through the hometown of Dick Tubb, the multi-talented Air Force doctor who traveled everywhere with me. I saw a hand-painted sign that read, "Welcome home, Dr. Tubb." Underneath in smaller print, the person had added, "You too, George W." Nothing buoyed my spirits like our supporters on the campaign trail. I was energized by their intensity, and their dedication inspired me to work harder so that I would not let them down. In the 16,500-person town of Poplar Bluff, Missouri, 23,000 people turned out for a speech. In the township of Westchester, Ohio, 41,000 people packed Voice of America Park. As I outlined John Kerry's shifting positions, a sea of arms swayed left and right amid a chant of flip-flop, flip-flop. Some people came dressed as human-sized flip-flops. I encountered new groups, including Barristers for Bush, Buckeyes for Bush, and Barbara and Jenna's favorite, Twins for Bush. I was especially encouraged by signs that read, God bless you. As I shook hands and posed for photos on the rope line, I was amazed by the number who said the same four words, I pray for you. I told them their prayers were a wonderful gift. They gave me strength. Seeing those voters also gave me hope that some Bush supporters who stayed home after the DUI revelation in 2000 would come back to the polls in 2004. John Kerry had intense supporters of his own. Hollywood filmmaker Michael Moore came out with a so-called documentary that was nothing more than campaign propaganda. In return, Kerry said that Hollywood entertainers conveyed the heart and soul of our country. Wealthy donors, like investment mogul George Soros, gave Kerry huge amounts of money through 527s, fundraising organizations that circumvented the campaign finance laws so many Democrats had championed. Renegade staffers at the CIA leaked information intended to embarrass the administration. The assault culminated in Dan Rather's false report, based on forged documents that I had not fulfilled my duties in the Texas Air National Guard. While the media was eager to scrutinize my military service, their appetite was noticeably less ravenous when Kerry's came into question. In February 2004, I sat down for an hour-long, one-on-one interview with Tim Russert. After grilling me mainly on Iraq, he pushed me on whether I would make all my military records available to the public. I promised I would. Soon after, I instructed the Defense Department to release every document related to my Guard service. You did yourself some good today, Mr. President, Tim said after the cameras went dark. Thanks, Tim, I said. By the way, I sure hope you will be as tough on John Kerry about his military records as you were on me. Oh, believe me, he said. We will. Tim interviewed John Kerry 2 months later, and he did ask about the military records. Kerry promised to release them to the public during the campaign, but he never did. At the Democratic National Convention in Boston, Kerry invited former shipmates and accepted the nomination with a salute. I'm John Kerry, and I'm reporting for duty, he declared in his opening line. His speech called for telling the truth to the American people and promised he would be a commander-in-chief who will never mislead us into war. Kerry's argument that I had misled the country on Iraq didn't pass the common sense test. As a member of the Senate in 2002, he had access to the same intelligence I did and decided to cast his vote in support of the war resolution. Kerry had trapped himself in a contradiction. My opponent hasn't answered the question of whether, knowing what we know now, he would have supported going into Iraq, I said at a campaign stop in New Hampshire. A few days later, standing on the rim of the Grand Canyon, Kerry took the bait. Yes, he said, I would have voted for the authority. It was a stunning admission. After using the grand stage of his convention to charge that I had misled America into war, one of the most serious allegations anyone can level at a commander-in-chief, John Kerry said he would vote to authorize the war again if he had the chance. Making the case against Kerry was important, but it was even more important to show voters that I would continue to lead on the big issues. I had seen incumbents like Ann Richards run backward-looking campaigns, and I vowed not to repeat their mistake. The only reason to look back in a campaign is to determine who best to lead us forward, I said. Even though we've done a lot, I'm here to tell you there's more to do. At the Republican National Convention in New York, and in speeches across the country, I laid out an ambitious second-term agenda. I pledged to modernize Social Security, reform the immigration system, and overhaul the tax code, while continuing No Child Left Behind and the faith-based initiative, implementing Medicare reform, and above all, fighting the war on terror. I crisscrossed the country throughout the fall, with interruptions for each of the three debates. The first was held at the University of Miami, Debating was a strong suit for John Kerry. Like a prize fighter, he charged out of his corner and punched furiously after every question. It was an effective technique. I spent too much time trying to sort through which of his many attacks to answer. I did land one roundhouse. McCary suggested that American military action should be subject to a global test. I countered, "I'm not exactly sure what you mean. Passes the global test. My attitude is you take preemptive action in order to protect the American people." On the car ride to the post-debate rally, I received a phone call from Karen Hughes. She told me the networks had broadcast split-screen images showing my facial expressions while Kerry was speaking. Apparently, I hadn't done a very good job of disguising my opinion of his answers. Just as Al Gore's size dominated the coverage of the first debate in 2000, my scowls became the story in 2004. I thought it was unfair both times. An even stranger story unfolded a few days later when a photograph from the debate surfaced. It showed a wrinkle down the back of my suit. Somebody came up with the idea that the crease was actually a hidden radio connected to Karl Rove. The rumor flew around the internet and became a sensation among conspiracy theorists. It was an early taste of a 21st century phenomenon, the political bloggers. In retrospect, it's too bad I didn't have a radio, so Karl could have told me to quit grimacing. The second and third debates went better. My face was calm, my suit was pressed, and I was better prepared to counter Kerry's jabs. But as is usually the case in presidential debates, the most damaging blow was self-inflicted. At our final debate in Tempe, moderator Bob Schieffer raised the topic of same-sex marriage and asked, "Do you believe homosexuality is a choice?" "I just don't know," I said. "I do know that we have a choice to make in America, and that is to treat people with tolerance and respect and dignity." I then expressed my conviction that marriage is between a man and a woman and said the law should reflect that time-honored truth. Kerry, who also opposed same-sex marriage, began his answer, "We're all God's children, Bob, and I think if you were to talk to Dick Cheney's daughter, who was a lesbian, she would tell you that she's being who she was. She's being who she was born as." I glanced at Laura, Barbara, and Jenna in the front row. I could see the shock on their faces. Karen Hughes later told me she heard audible gasps. There is an unwritten rule in American politics that a candidate's children are off limits. For John Kerry to raise my running mate's daughter's sexuality in a nationally televised debate was appalling. It was not unprecedented. In the vice presidential debate a week earlier, Kerry's running mate, North Carolina Senator John Edwards, also found a way to bring up the issue. One reference might have been an accident. Two was a plot. Kerry and Edwards were hoping to peel off conservative voters who objected to Dick's daughter's orientation. Instead, they came across looking cynical and mean. Lynn Cheney spoke for a lot of us when she called it a cheap and tawdry political trick. In 2000, our October surprise had come in the form of the DUI revelation. In 2004, it came from Osama bin Laden. On October 29th, the Al-Qaeda leader released a videotape threatening Americans with another Manhattan and mocking my response to 9/11 in the Florida classroom. It sounded like he was plagiarizing Michael Moore. "Americans will not be intimidated or influenced by an enemy of our country," I said. John Kerry made a similar statement of resolve. The final election day of my political career, November 2, 2004, began aboard Marine One, on a midnight flight from Dallas to the ranch. We had just finished an emotional rally with 8,000 supporters at Southern Methodist University, Laura's alma mater, my seventh stop on a day-long 2,500-mile blitz across the country. Laura, Barbara, Jenna, and I were up at dawn the next day. We eagerly cast our ballots at the Crawford Firehouse, four solid votes in the Bush-Cheney column. I trust the judgment of the American people, I told the assembled reporters. My hope, of course, is that this election ends tonight. I checked in with Brother Jeb. Florida is looking good, George, the governor said. Then I spoke to Carl. He was a little worried about Ohio, so off we went for my 20th campaign stop in the Buckeye State. After thanking the volunteers and working a phone bank in Columbus, we loaded up for the flight to D.C. As the plane descended toward Andrews Air Force Base, Carl came to the front cabin. The first round of exit polls had arrived. They're dreadful, he said. I felt like he had just punched me in the stomach. I was down more than 20 points in the battleground state of Pennsylvania. Rock-solid Republican states like Mississippi and South Carolina were too close to call. If the numbers were right, I would suffer a landslide defeat. I walked from the airplane to Marine One in a daze. The 10-minute flight to the White House felt like hours. Finally, the wheels of the chopper hit the South Lawn. The press corps swarmed to get a good shot for the evening news. Karen Hughes had good advice. Everybody, smile. I went upstairs to the residence and moped around the treaty room. I just couldn't believe it. After all the hard work of the past 4 years and all the grueling months on the campaign trail, I was going to be voted out of office decisively. I knew life would go on, as it had for Dad, but the rejection was going to sting. Before long, Carl called. He had been crunching the numbers and was convinced that the methodology was flawed. I felt relieved and angry at the same time. I worried that the bogus numbers would demoralize our supporters and depress turnout in time zones where the polling places were still open. We were thinking the same thing. Here we go again. At 8 p.m., the polls in Florida closed. As Jeb predicted that morning, the early returns looked promising. The exit poll results in South Carolina and Mississippi were quickly contradicted by solid victories in both states. The rest of the East Coast came in as expected. The outcome would turn on four states: Iowa, New Mexico, Nevada, and Ohio. Ken Melman, my brilliant campaign manager who had organized a historic effort to turn out the vote, was confident we had won all four states. Each had been called in our favor by at least one news network. But after the fiasco of 2000, no network wanted to be the first to put me over the top. The focus was Ohio, with its 20 electoral votes. I held a solid lead of more than 120,000 votes. The clock struck midnight, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock. At around 2:45, I took a phone call from Tony Blair. He told me he had gone to bed in London thinking I had lost and was prepared to deal with President Kerry. Not only did you win, George, he said, you got more votes than any president in history. If only the Kerry campaign would recognize that, I replied. I haven't been up this late since college. At around 4 o'clock, we started hearing rumors that Kerry and Edwards planned to file a lawsuit contesting the vote in Ohio. In another replay of 2000, several advisors urged me to declare victory even though the networks hadn't called the race and my opponent had not conceded. 4 years earlier, it was Jeb who wisely advised me against giving my speech in Austin. This time it was Laura. George, you can't go out there, she said. Wait until you've been declared the winner. At around the same time, Dan Bartlett picked up a useful piece of intelligence. Nicole Wallace, my campaign's communications director, had connected Dan with Kerry aide Mike McCurry. McCurry told him the senator would make the right decision if we gave him time. Don't press the guy, Dan advised. Once again, a disappointed crowd waited for a candidate who never arrived. I so wanted to give my supporters the victory party we had been denied in 2000, but it wasn't to be. Just after 5 a.m., I sent Andy Card in my place. President Bush decided to give Senator Kerry the respect of more time to reflect on the results of this election, he said. We are convinced that President Bush has won re-election with at least 286 electoral votes. At 11:02 the next morning, my personal assistant, Ashley Kavanaugh, opened the door to the Oval Office. "Mr. President," she said, "I have Senator Kerry on the line." John was gracious. I told him he was a worthy opponent who had run a spirited campaign. I called Laura and hugged the small group of senior aides gathered in the Oval Office. I walked down the hallway to Dick's office, where I gave him a hearty handshake. Dick isn't really the hugging type. Eventually, I reached Mother and Dad on the phone. After staying up most of the night, they had slipped out of the White House early that morning and flown back to Houston without knowing the results. "Congratulations, son," Dad said. He said it more with relief than joy. We hadn't talked about it, but 2000 was not the only election that had been on our minds. We both remembered the pain of 1992. I could tell he was very happy I would not have to go through what he had. After its bleak start, election night 2004 had turned into a big victory. I became the first president to win a majority of the popular vote since Dad in 1988. As in 2002, Republicans gained ground in both the House and Senate. The day after Kerry conceded, I held a morning press conference. One of the reporters asked if I felt more free. I thought about the ambitious agenda I had outlined over the past year. "Let me put it to you this way," I said. "I earned capital in the campaign, political capital, and now I intend to spend it." For as long as I can remember, Social Security has been the third rail of American politics. Grab a hold of it, and you're toast. In 2005, I did more than touch the third rail. I hugged it. I did so for one reason. It is unfair to make a generation of young people pay into a system that is going broke. Created by Franklin Roosevelt in 1935, Social Security is a pay-as-you-go system. The checks collected by retirees are financed by payroll taxes paid by today's workers. The system worked fine when there were 40 workers for every beneficiary, as there were in 1935. But over time, demographics changed. Life expectancy rose. The birth rate fell. As a result, by 2005, there were only 3 workers paying into the Social Security system for every beneficiary taking money out. By the time a young person starting work in the first decade of the 21st century retires, the ratio will be 2-1. To compound the problem, Congress had set Social Security benefits to rise faster than inflation. Starting in 2018, Social Security was projected to take in less money than it paid out. The shortfall would increase every year, until the system hit bankruptcy in 2042. The year 2042 sounded a long way off, until I did the math. That was when my daughters, born in 1981, would be approaching retirement. For someone looking to take on big issues, it didn't get much bigger than reforming Social Security. I decided there was no better time to launch the effort than when I was fresh off re-election. I started by setting 3 principles for reform. First, nothing would change for seniors or people near retirement. Second, I would seek to make Social Security solvent without raising payroll taxes, which had already expanded from about 2% to 12%. Third, younger workers should have the option of earning a better return by investing part of their Social Security taxes in a personal retirement account. Personal retirement accounts would be new to Social Security, but most Americans were familiar with the concept. Like 401k accounts, they could be invested in a safe mix of stock and bond funds, which would grow over time and benefit from the power of compound interest. The accounts would be managed by reputable financial institutions charging low fees, and there would be prohibitions against withdrawing the money before retirement. Even at a conservative rate of return of 3%, an account holder's money would double every 24 years. By contrast, Social Security's return of 1.2% would take 60 years to double. Unlike Social Security benefits, personal retirement accounts would be an asset owned by individual workers, not the government, and could be passed from one generation to the next. In early 2005, I sat down with Republican congressional leaders to talk through our legislative strategy. I told them, modernizing Social Security would be my first priority. The reaction was lukewarm at best. "Mr. President," one leader said, "this is not a popular issue. Taking on Social Security will cost us seats." "No," I shot back. "Failing to tackle this issue will cost us seats." It was clear they were thinking about the 2-year election cycle of Capitol Hill. I was thinking about the responsibility of a president to lead on issues affecting the long-term prospects of the country. I reminded them that I had campaigned on this issue twice, and the problem was only going to get worse. By solving it, we would do the country a great service, and ultimately, good policy makes for good politics. "If you lead, we'll be behind you," one House leader said. "But we'll be way behind you." The meeting with congressional Republicans showed what an uphill climb I had on Social Security. I decided to press ahead anyway. When I looked back on my presidency, I didn't want to say I had dodged a big issue. Social Security was a great moral success of the 20th century, and we must honor its great purposes in this new century. I said in my 2005 State of the Union address, "The system, however, on its current path, is headed toward bankruptcy, and so we must join together to strengthen and save Social Security." The next day, I embarked on a series of trips to raise awareness about Social Security's problems and rally the American people to insist on change. I gave speeches, convened town halls, and even held an event with my favorite Social Security beneficiary, Mother. "I'm here because I'm worried about our 17 grandchildren, and so is my husband," she said. "They will get no Social Security." One of my most memorable trips was to a Nissan auto manufacturing plant in Canton, Mississippi. Many in the audience were African-American workers. I asked how many had money invested in a 401k. Almost every hand in the room shot up. I love the idea of people who had not traditionally owned assets having a nest egg they could call their own. I also thought about how much more was possible. Social Security was especially unfair to African Americans. Because their life expectancy was shorter, black workers who spent a lifetime paying into Social Security received an average of $21,000 less in benefits than whites of comparable income levels. Personal accounts, which could be passed along to the next generation, would go a long way toward reducing that disparity. On April 28th, I called a primetime press conference to lay out a specific proposal. The plan I embraced was the brainchild of a Democrat, Robert Posen. His proposal, known as progressive indexing, set benefits to grow fastest for the poorest Americans and slowest for the wealthiest. There would be a sliding scale for everyone in between. By changing the benefit growth formula, the plan would wipe out the vast majority of the Social Security shortfall. In addition, all Americans would have the opportunity to earn higher returns through personal retirement accounts. I hoped both sides would embrace the proposal. Republicans would be pleased that we could vastly improve the budget outlook without raising taxes. Democrats should have been pleased by a reform that saved Social Security, the crown jewel of the New Deal, by offering the greatest benefits to the poor, minorities, and the working class, the constituents they claim to represent. My legislative team pushed the plan hard, but it received virtually no support. Democratic leaders in the House and Senate alleged I wanted to privatize Social Security. That was obviously poll-tested language designed to scare people. It wasn't true. My plan saved Social Security, modernized Social Security, and gave Americans the opportunity to own a piece of their Social Security. It did not privatize Social Security. I sensed there was something broader behind the Democrats' opposition. National Economic Council Director Al Hubbard told me about a meeting he'd had on Capitol Hill. "I'd like to be helpful on this," one senior Democratic senator told him, "but our leaders have made clear we're not supposed to cooperate." The rigid Democratic opposition on Social Security came in stark contrast to the bipartisanship I had been able to forge on No Child Left Behind and during my years in Texas. I was disappointed by the change, and I've often thought about why it occurred. I think there was some on the other side of the aisle who never got over the 2000 election and were determined not to cooperate with me. Others resented that I had campaigned against Democratic incumbents in 2002 and 2004, helping Republican candidates unseat Democratic icons like Senator Max Cleland of Georgia and Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle. No doubt I bear some of the responsibility as well. I don't regret campaigning for fellow Republicans. I had always made clear that I intended to increase our party's strength in Washington. While I was willing to fine-tune legislation in response to Democratic concerns, I would not compromise my principles, which was what some seemed to expect in return for cooperation. On Social Security, I may have misread the electoral mandate by pushing for an issue on which there had been little bipartisan agreement in the first place. Whatever the cause, the breakdown in bipartisanship was bad for my administration, and bad for the country, too. With no Democrats on board, I needed strong Republican backing to get a Social Security bill through Congress. I didn't have it. Many younger Republicans, such as Congressman Paul Ryan of Wisconsin, supported reform, but few in Congress were willing to address such a contentious issue. The collapse of Social Security reform is one of the greatest disappointments of my presidency. Despite our efforts, the government ended up doing exactly what I had warned against. We kicked the problem down the road to the next generation. In retrospect, I'm not sure what I could have done differently. I made the case for reform as widely and persuasively as I could. I tried hard to reach across the aisle and made a Democratic economist's proposal the crux of my plan. The failure of Social Security reform shows the limits of the president's power. If Congress is determined not to act, there is only so much a president can do. Inaction had a cost. In the 5 years since I proposed reform, the Social Security crisis has grown more acute. The projected bankruptcy date has moved from 2042 to 2037. The shortfall in Social Security, the cost of fixing the problem, has grown more than $2 trillion since I raised the issue in 2005. That is more than we spent on the war in Iraq, Medicare modernization, and the troubled asset relief program combined. For anyone concerned about the deficits facing future generations, the failure to reform Social Security ranks among the most expensive missed opportunities of modern times. She was standing on the doorstep, alone in the rain. She looked tired and scared. A few days earlier, Paula Rendon had said goodbye to her family in Mexico and boarded a bus bound for Houston. She arrived with no money and no friends. All she had was an address, 5525 Briar Drive, and the names of her new employers, George and Barbara Bush. I was 13 years old when I opened the door that evening in 1959. Before long, Paula became like a second mother to my younger brothers and sister and me. She worked hard, taking care of our family in Texas and her own in Mexico. Eventually, she bought a home and moved her